For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. One, the Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. I'm Don Mazzello. With us today is Sally Plabete. She's CEO of Wealthy, a very fascinating website that I'm going to let her tell us a little bit about herself, her company, and her website. Welcome, Sally. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us first a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I have had a long career, over 20 years in healthcare and health insurance specifically. I spent a number of years working within an insurance carrier, developing insurance products. So really have deep expertise about the products that are available today out in the marketplace. I am also a licensed insurance broker and have, really enjoy providing guidance and advice to mostly small businesses, as well as individuals in my network, but providing guidance and advice as people have questions regarding the very important decision of offering health coverage for their employees. And currently, I am the founder and CEO of Wealthy, which is a technology company that is modernizing the way that small businesses shop for insurance. So we're really bringing the very best of technology, user experience, design, data, and relationships that we have with the industry, such as insurance companies and brokers, to come together to create a really unique platform that, again, modernizes and transforms the way that small businesses can find and access insurance options.
Well, what's the name of the website?
Sure. It is wealthy.com/small business, and that is WELLTHIE.com, and then /small business.
Okay. And what makes it so unique? I know, but tell our audience what it's about.
Sure. So this is really aimed at a small business with 50 employees or less. They could also have 100 employees in New York or California, but a small business who has employees and looking to figure out how much health insurance costs for their employees and thinking about that decision, or if they already are offering coverage at the moment, wanting to just look at what other options may be available in their market. So this is a website that is like Zillow or like Kayak, in that we have aggregated hundreds of carriers, thousands of plans, that is accessible to that small business owner at any time of day or night that they have free time. You know, one of the most common things about small business owners and founders is that they're obviously pressed for time and very busy. So whenever they're free and available, rather than having to leave messages and find this information out, really it's really accessible at their fingertips. They only need to put in very little information, such as their zip code, and instantly they'll be able to find options and kind of minimum prices that of premiums of plans that are available in their market. So really getting a quick snapshot of what's available. Digging in deeper by providing the employees' birth dates or ages, then this website can create a more customized quote for the business that really, you know, it shows great options at different price points from a lot of different top carriers in the country, and then they can compare and contrast and easily filter and look at those different options. And at any point along the way, if the business owner has a question about what something means, or if they're ready to go ahead and sign up, or if they just still want to evaluate but do have some questions, they can very easily schedule a call with a licensed broker expert or live chat right there online and be able to ask their questions and have a qualified licensed expert respond to them.
Well, that was a mouthful, but it says it in. And I have to tell you, I've tried your website. A question I have: if I have 49 employees, I can put all 49 people in there, and it'll come back with a fairly accurate quote.
Absolutely, a very accurate quote, in fact. And yes, 49 employees. If you put in there, we do need age, and let me just explain why. Because the insurance rules around the country and is such that, you know, different ages would yield a different premium. So that's why age is really important. And we could also estimate the cost for spouses and dependents. So the business owner, if he or she had that information, can put those in and also estimate all of that at the same time. So just having the age and the zip code is really important, and then we can go from there.
Hmm. Well, I know just enough about healthcare to be dangerous, like a lot of people, and certainly never quite. Mastered my own, let alone the company's healthcare. How do you work it so that the small business owner can find the plan, the cheapest plan, which is where they want to start, that fits their needs?
Yeah, well, I think that it's important to understand a couple of concepts and terms that I'll define right now, and then because different insurance plans really fit the needs of different employees. So I think the first and foremost, the price that you will see is called the premium. The premium is what the cost of that insurance plan is that is going to be charged to the business owner. One thing that, as a point of fact, business owners don't have to cover 100% of that premium. Business owners can cover really what is available in their budget, anywhere from like 50 to 100% of that. On average, business owners, have trended to cover about 70, 75% of the premium. So again, but what we'll display on the website is the 100% cost, just so that that is clear to everybody. So you can first look at the lowest cost, right? That's pretty easy to figure out because it's going to sort by that. Then I think the next thing to consider is that usually the plans with the lowest monthly premium would also require the employees to pay more out of pocket when they go to the doctor. And that is called the cost share. The cost share is what the combination of deductibles and copay and coinsurance that an employee would have to pay when they go to the doctor. And usually that's the trade-off. A higher premium usually means a lower out-of-pocket cost when you go to the doctor or the hospital, and a lower premium means a higher out-of-pocket cost. So what this all means is that if the employees of the business have a lot of healthcare needs, it isn't always cheaper in the long run to get the plan with the lowest premium, so that there is benefit to getting kind of the middle-of-the-road plan, which is categorized. These are categorized by metal levels: bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. So the middle of the road would be a silver plan, and as opposed to the bronze plan, which is the least expensive from a premium standpoint, but also would entail having to pay more out of pocket. So the bronze plans usually are more geared towards people with less healthcare needs, where they just need to go to the doctor once a year or two for preventive care kinds of things, and use their healthcare for emergency purposes. But for people that have need to routinely go to the doctor because they're managing a chronic condition or they expect to get, surgery or something like that in the year, then I would suggest looking at the silver and gold categories in terms of the ranges of premiums. And then I'll mention one more thing, and that is the type of plan. There are a variety of plans available. There are plans that are called HMOs. Health Maintenance Organization is what that acronym stands for. And usually that means that the list of doctors or the network of doctors that an employee can go to is defined, and employees are usually not able to go to see a doctor outside of that network. That can sometimes be a lower cost type of plan than a PPO, which is a preferred provider organization. And the PPO is a type of plan whereby there's a broader list of doctors, and there are benefits if you stay within that list of doctors, but you could also go to a doctor that's not on that list and still get some of the insurance. The insurance would still pay some of the services when you go out of network. So I'll just summarize all that to say, if a business owner has employees that don't really have a lot of health care needs, then going to choosing the lower premium bronze or silver plans with a more limited network, an HMO or what's called a narrow network, could be a decent option. But for businesses where they expect their employees to go to the doctor quite a bit, then I would, you know, suggest more along the silver or gold category and really think about the network a bit more carefully, because that is impacting the hospitals and the doctors that the employees can go to.
Sally, that was absolutely terrific. We're talking with Sally Poblete. Poblete, of Wealthy. Spell your website again for people.
Sure, it's wellthie.com/smallbusiness.
You also provide this service for larger organizations as well?
No, not at this time. We really are very focused on the needs of small businesses. Again, for small businesses around the country under 50 employees, and then in states like California and New York, up to 100 employees.
Well, another question is, what do you say about HSAs?
HSAs are a terrific vehicle to save money. I highly recommend it. Employees who have HSAs can really save money through that vehicle for future healthcare expenses. They're able to save that pre-tax, and then when they use it, it's also tax-free. So it is really a great vehicle. If and when they switch jobs, they can carry that HSA with them. It doesn't, unlike an FSA, which is an account that you can also save money into, but it expires at the end of the year. An HSA doesn't expire. It can continue to grow, and investment or interest income or investment income from an HSA can also grow and is tax-free. So there's really a lot of great advantages to having a health savings account, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, but my understanding is the average deductible and now is closer to the $5,000 range than any time in the future. And my first question is it true that it's the average deductible is now approaching $5,000?
Yes. Deductibles in health insurance are increasing, and that is a trend that has been, you know, going on for quite some time. So yes, in fact, it is around that $5,000 mark, and I would say it is a way for when insurers, you know, design their plans, that deductible really does help lower the premium of the plan, which is part of the reason that that number has been climbing.
Yeah, and I'm told it's also very difficult to find deductibles under that threshold nowadays. Is that correct?
No, not really. There's actually quite a number of lots of plans that are available with a lower deductible. It is only the case that the lower deductibles would also tend to have a higher premium. So people who are looking to save on the monthly cost of a policy, you know, will be looking at plans that generally have a higher deductible. So it's not that the plans are, you know, there aren't enough plans available in the low deductible. They just tend to be at a higher premium per month.
Well, also, there are many dental extra, eyesight extra, et cetera. And they tend to drive costs up. But Am I right in that? And is it also that the smaller businesses tend to be more bare bones than larger businesses?
That's a great question. I think that small businesses are, I think by definition, just generally speaking, really care about their employees and always want to provide the most amount of benefits that they can. So I just as a general matter, it is very, very common to offer additional benefits to their employees. I think about 30% of so or so offer dental insurance. Close to 40% offer life insurance, and then businesses can also offer products on what's called a voluntary basis, which means the business doesn't necessarily shoulder the cost of those benefits, but they just enable the employees to buy benefits directly. So I would encourage, businesses that are currently offering benefits or looking to do so to also consider the additional dental, vision, life, and other plans to include, because after all, right, those are all part of our general health, and I think it's if the budget would allow budget allows for it, I think that those plans are great to consider. And then I'll also mention that there are increasingly increasing number of medical insurance companies that are offering some of the, very basic dental or vision coverage as part of the medical. It's still a new trend, but certainly, it's worth checking out to see if, an eye exam or any kind of bundled in dental or vision is a part of that. I'll also mention telemedicine. I'm a big fan of telemedicine because it does save on, trips to the doctor or in terms of just very basic, consultation and where you can get more immediate help, so long as, of course, it's not an emergency or not something that is really a complicated medical issue. So those telemedicine benefits are can be purchased as a buy-up onto the medical plan, or some medical plans are now starting to cover that as well. So I'd be on the lookout for those because, again, they really help in terms of productivity of the employees and just really saving time and getting access to great care at a very, very convenient manner.
Well, we have in this country, it's seemingly a dichotomy. And please, I'm trying to remember the figures exactly, but it seems that younger people still have a tendency not to have health insurance, and particularly in many of these startup companies, the medical plans are less than desirable. Could you comment on that?
Well, actually, we're seeing that, Don, that more and more employers who are able to afford, are able to add, employee benefits to their budget, regardless of age, really, whether it's a young, startup company, technology company, or manufacturing company with middle-aged employees, or even those who are trending higher. We're seeing that, small businesses, unemployment is at an all-time low, and there's just a lot of growth and a lot of competition for talent. There's really an increase in, providing benefits, looking for creative ways to keep employees happy and healthy in the workplace and at home. So we're seeing more coverage than less coverage, and more creative ways to, again, offer, wellness benefits and things like that to keep employees happy and healthy. And then just generally speaking, think that, that's a very good practice.
We're talking with Sally. I'm having trouble with your name. Sally
Poblete.
Poblete. Let me start over. Sally Poblete. She's CEO of Wellthie, Wellthie.com. It's a fascinating, I recommend it highly. It's a great place to find the true and potential cost of health care. It's a very illuminating site. I've worked it. Sally, what made you decide to do this?
That's a great question, Don. You know, a couple of things. One, I'm, you know, within my network of family and friends, I seem to always be the go-to for, you know, healthcare consumer kinds of questions, how to pick this, how to pick that, how to choose, and how to navigate the healthcare system. I studied a graduate program in healthcare, and I have had a, you know, long career in, as I said, in the industry. And I think universally people have a lot of questions about the topic of, right, insurance and navigating it. And it's my expertise and my passion, and I wanted to leverage technology, build a team of people who are equally inspired to make things simpler and really create an improvement and create more transparency and more healthcare literacy, right? Increase the literacy and understanding of this topic, and that ultimately is what drives us every day. You know, the industry is indeed complex. There are a lot of terminologies and things that can be very technical to a layperson, but we're dedicated to making things simpler and easier, and having a very successful time at it. You know, our company's growing, and we most importantly really enjoy what we do.
Well, how long have you been in business?
Yeah, over 5 years.
Wow. And mm-hmm. I'm just finding out about you now. I wish I'd known about you earlier.
Yeah, well, we certainly have, been doing a lot of different things within the health insurance industry. We've worked a number of years with insurance companies, and the latest launch of this new platform to small businesses is something that we just recently announced this month. So in fact, it is quite new, and really excited about being able to share it with everybody.
Mm-hmm. So the website again for people, because we're coming to the end of our time together.
Sure, it is wellthie.com/smallbusiness.
And if they wanted to get in touch with you directly, can they do that?
Sure, my email is spoblete@wellthie.com.
So can you spell it out?
Sure, it's spoblete@wellthie.com.
Okay, Sally. A link to your website will be on our website tonight. We thank you so much for joining us.
That sounds good. Thank you very much for having me, Don. It was a pleasure, and we'll talk soon.
Hold on, Charlie. Sally, we're going to have to redo this one. We've just been acquired, and come February, I'd like you to come back on with a new voice and redo this show for our wider audience.
That sounds good. I'd be delighted to do that.
I will talk to your PR people about that, but we want you back in September.
Thank you. Sounds good. Happy to be come back. Thank you, Don.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, This show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you. I'm Don Mazzella, and we're here with Claudette Rowley. She's the author of Cultural Brilliance, the DNA of Organizational Experience. Claudette, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks so much, John. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I just made a mistake. It's the DNA of Organizational Excellence. So let's get the name of the book correct. Claudette,
sounds good.
Tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about the book, and where people can get it.
Thanks. I'm happy to. So my background is I've been an organizational and culture consultant for about 20 years and an executive coach. And prior to that, I was a social worker. So I've always been in the business of helping people, helping organizations move forward and improve in different ways. The book, Cultural Brilliance, is really about helping people and organizations have a new way of thinking about culture. And it gives a new idea in terms of this, that cultures can be brilliant, that they can really bring out the positivity and the invention and the best in people and organizations. And then the book goes on to actually give a step-by-step way of doing that. So someone who reads the book could actually take this and apply it in their company. And the best way to find it is either through my website, which is culturalbrilliance.com, or directly through Amazon.
Okay. Well, now, having set it up, I'm going to ask, what are the two or three top line about your book?
The two or three top lines about the book. Yeah, I think really two things. One is that we can, if we can really think about culture differently and change the culture of our businesses, we can also make a big contribution to the world. And then I think that culture, a lot of organizations don't tap the business potential that they have. And the business potential resides in their culture. And this book can give them a roadmap for doing that.
Well, explain that a little bit further, Claudette. Are you saying, in effect, that companies can do better than they are doing by developing this cultural brilliance?
I think so, yeah. And, of course, there are companies that are doing great, right? And we've heard about them in the media, Google, lots of small companies I can think of that most of us have never heard of that have great cultures. And then there are a lot of companies that are moving forward and doing the very best they can based on what they know right now. But when I work with them, there's so much more possible for them in terms of the people that work for them and then how that impacts their bottom line, their innovation, their productivity, those kinds of things.
Okay, well, let's stop and let me ask you a question. Can you name one or two companies that have this cultural brilliance that you've seen?
I know, for example, and this is in the book, I talk about a study that Google did, and Google has a lot of the attributes I talk about in terms of having a brilliant culture. And one of the main ones that that came out in the study, and some listeners may be familiar with it, was that their teams had what was called psychological safety, which meant that the team members felt comfortable to bring up the fact that they'd made a mistake and discuss it and learn from it, that they could take risks, they could stretch and grow in different ways. And it didn't mean that they wouldn't get constructive feedback around it. It just meant that they didn't have to worry about their jobs, or they didn't have to worry that there was going to be retribution or someone would, talk behind their backs in a negative way. And that was one of the hallmarks of their culture, and certainly is one of the hallmarks of a brilliant culture as well.
So you're in effect saying if I understand it correctly, if a company can tolerate mistakes, that they will eventually add to it, rather than hampered by it. Am I hearing that right?
I think that's part of it. Absolutely. That if a company, you mentioned, use the word tolerate mistakes, and it's almost more if they encourage smart mistakes, right? So I take the risk to try something. It doesn't work exactly as I'd hoped. So there's a mistake in there, And then I learn from it, and I share that learning with the rest of my team so we can all benefit and move forward. So it's not making the same mistake over and over again. It's really taking the whatever that hasn't gone well and using it to improve going forward.
Well, you know, just yesterday I was reading an item how bubble wrap was actually the result of a mistaken effort on a part of a company. I believe it was 3M. But anyway, but the irony of it was that the scientist who did the mistake was fired. And I thought that was the really great irony about it. But, you know, I see so many cases of examples. You see it all the time in football. Kansas City Chiefs just fired their defensive coordinator because he couldn't stop the Patriots on their last drive. But can you give other examples of what other things a brilliant organization tolerates?
Yeah, so brilliant, absolutely. I'm happy to. So, you know, brilliant cultures are looking at certainly that psychological safety I mentioned, but they're also looking at ways to really make great opportunities for people to tell the truth and actually the truth about their experiences and use that truth to help move the culture forward. There's also a lot around looking at problems in terms of opportunities, right? So we're always solving problems, most of us, all day long. And it's more looking at how does that problem get solved in a way that drives our business, that allows us to adapt to change in a much more proactive way. The other thing that's a hallmark of brilliant cultures is that people actually understand how their culture operates. And that in a lot of companies we know, people don't have a deep understanding of their own cultures because it's kind of hard to understand without some assessment work. So in brilliant cultures, you're going to see that people understand their culture, so they use it to their benefit. So there's a lot more productivity and innovation because people understand the inner dynamics of how they're working together.
We're talking with Claudette Rowley. Her book is Cultural Brilliance, The DNA of Organizational Excellence. Claudette, I'm listening to you, and I agree with you, but I often see organizations driven by fear rather than opportunity. How do you, if you identify such a company, how do you change it?
Yeah, one of the ways you can, I agree with you, there's a lot of companies driven by fear. One of the ways you initially change it is by, you know, acknowledging it, really creating a place where people can feel safe to take the risk to talk about why are they driven by fear? You know, what's going on in the organization and in the culture that's created that dynamic? And then also do some assessment work on how the culture operates, because you can actually, once you identify the root cause of the fear and bring it to everybody's attention, you can actually start to work with the organization and the leadership, of course, to shift that and say, you know, a culture based on fear is not going to be successful in the long run. What would it be like to have a culture based on trust, a culture based on innovation, right? On enjoying your work and being engaged. That kind of energy transforms organizations.
Well, you know, we're a program aimed at small business. And what I've found oftentimes is a small business is driven by the leaders, usually one or two people. And their view is you do it my way or the highway. And how do you transfer what you're saying to a smaller organization?
Yeah, it's a great question. And a company I've been working with comes to mind, which is a small manufacturing company that's been around for about 35 years. And in that case, you know, it's really getting, like you said, because it's usually one or two leaders who are really driving what happens, it was getting that particular person on board with what we wanted to do. And the reason he got interested was because they were starting to have an increase in sales volume, which is a great thing, except that they were starting to have their operations were having a hard time handling the increase in volume. And it was actually due to there were some deep cultural reasons for that. And so it was, you know, unfortunately, as is often the case, especially with smaller companies, it's because the pain level got high enough that the leaders were willing to take a look at the culture and say, oh, I can see where you're coming from now, and let's work on resolving this. So it was getting at the pain points. And I think that's true for a lot of smaller businesses.
Oh, very definitely. They don't want to change until they need to change in order to survive. But how do you get them to recognize that this is the case? I mean, oftentimes, we see in the big things, Sears is a great example of a company that literally drove itself into the ground. But how do you get companies to recognize this need?
I typically do it by being very, you know, very, very direct about it and saying, this is what I'm seeing happening, right? This is the dynamic. This is the situation, right? You're having operational issues for these particular reasons. And if you continue to not do anything about it, right, here are the negative consequences of it, right? Like Sears. So it's, for me, it's having a very direct conversation about what I've observed, what I've heard, what I've noticed, and really mapping it out. Even when it's hard for a leadership team to hear, telling the truth about what I've seen. And sometimes people say, yeah, you know what, we need to do something about this. And sometimes, of course, they don't. They simply don't want to see it.
Oh, that's very true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We here in New Jersey, we have the problem of a newly elected governor had a flaw in his organization, and as far as the legislature investigative committee, no one would tell him the truth about a problem. How do you get people to talk the truth in situations where? We all know the Titanic is sinking, but no one will tell the captain.
No one will tell the captain. Yeah, yeah. And everybody knows except the captain in some cases, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's really helping people. When I'm in that situation as a consultant, it's helping people. Sometimes people don't tell the truth because they don't know how to. They don't know the words for it. They're concerned. Of course, they're afraid sometimes. So I'm working with, you know, helping them decide what's their approach. How do they want to do this? Do we want to have a group of people talk to someone? Do we want to have one person, you know, what's the best strategy? And really go through and address their fears involved and try to make it as safe as possible. I think the reason people don't tell the truth is because of real fear, right, of retribution, or sometimes it's perceived that really nothing will happen to them if they tell the truth, but they're just so nervous or anxious or afraid to do it, they don't. So it's also helping them understand, is your fear perceived, or is there a real consequence for you if you do tell the truth? And that's a really important distinction.
Well, you know, let's go back to your book. You know, truth is... I guess what you make of it, but how do you get people to talk about the truth?
So when I'm doing consulting in organizations, we create something called a cultural safety zone, which is simply a way of saying we're going to actually have a conversation about how we have the conversation about the truth. So having that organization or team decide on some ground rules, some guardrails for the conversation about, you know, what are our values, how are we going to behave, what's okay, what's not okay, to try to make it as safe as possible for people to have that conversation. And as you said, the truth is what you make of it, that my truth is not someone else's truth, right? So it is our perceptions of our experiences. So you want to have an opportunity also for people to have different opinions, right? They're not all going to see things the same way. But knowing that when everyone's voice gets heard in that way, that you're going to get closer to that truth, that collective truth.
We're talking with Claudette Rowley. She's the author of Cultural Brilliance, The DNA of Organizational Excellence. Claudette, let's talk a little bit about some of the other things in your book. Anything you'd like to talk about specifically?
Sure. One thing I like to always touch base on is some of the signs that you may have a cultural issue in your organization that you need to address. And there are a few different ones that I outline. One is, if speaking of truth, since we just were, if you have a culture in which people get actually punished for telling the truth, you have a cultural issue. If you're tolerating bullies in your organization, that bullying behavior, especially if it's that, I mean, any bullying behavior, but some organizations will justify it because they have someone who's a rainmaker or holds the biggest account, right, is really productive in certain ways, but they wreak a lot of havoc in the rest of the organization. You know, that's a cultural issue. Another one is if your culture makes people leave, if you have a steady line of people leaving your company, time to take a look at your culture. And the final one I'll mention quickly is that if you have a leadership team or a leader that keeps asking for data and information, which is a good thing to do, but then they don't do anything with it repeatedly, which of course we know is really frustrating to people and tends to disengage them, then you may want to take a look at your culture as well. So those are, and then if you have, you know, an organization with silent meetings, people aren't speaking up. I mean, those are all good opportunities to take a look at how your culture works.
Would you mind repeating them? That is so good. Would you mind repeating them, Claudette?
Oh, sure. Not at all. So if your people are punished for telling the truth in your organization, if you tolerate bullying behavior, if your culture is making people leave, you have a lot of people leaving your organization, and you have a leadership team or a leader that asks for data and information and then doesn't do anything with it on a regular basis.
Good things to keep in mind. You know, I've been out of big organizations for a long time, and talking to people inside, we ran into a situation quite recently, and I'll toss it out at you because they put in a new woman as a supervisor of four very big areas. And as the man, they literally put her in between one person and four others, and not of the choosing of the person above. But then what it turned out that this woman, every one of the department heads that reported to her, reported that she, when they disagreed with her, said, "You are bullying me." Now, there's a situation where she said, "I feel as if I'm being used all of the feminist words." Now, this is something that we are facing in the world today. I guess the question is, how do you deal with situations like that? In this case, the people underneath are being told that they're bullying the woman above.
Yeah, and that's such an important point. Thanks for bringing it up. I think, you know, when I'm talking about bullying behavior, I'm talking about, you know, bullies usually operate in very repetitive ways. They have patterns of behavior of, you know, intimidating somebody, humiliating somebody, treating someone really badly over and over again. And what I sometimes, you know, what we'll hear in organizations is, oh, that person's a bully, or that's bullying behavior because they had one bad day, right? Because they have a kind of an abrupt manner, because they blew up one time. And I'm not saying any of those things are good things, but that's different than being a bully, right? You know, someone having a bad day or having an abrupt manner is not bullying behavior. It may need to be addressed. It may not have been acceptable, but it's not bullying. And so I think it's getting really clear in organizations about what bullying actually is and what it's not, so that it's addressed appropriately. Because it can be easy to say, oh, yeah, that person's bullying me, and then they become almost a scapegoat when it may not be the case at all.
So we've got to take it at some measurement and say, is it a repetitive one or is it a singular one? Am I hearing you right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are many resources online. There's an institute called the Bullying Institute. It's a very research-based institute where people, if they're wondering if something's bullying or not bullying a behavior, they can fairly easily look it up because there's so much research that's been done on it. So, yeah, I think it's knowing what you're really looking at and experiencing is important.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's good advice to keep in mind. You know, we have a few minutes left, and what I'd like to do is talk about things you like to talk about, because your book is fascinating. I have to tell you, the book is called The DNA of Organizational Excellence. We're talking with Claudette Rowley, but Claudette, give us another point in the book that you'd like our audience to know about.
Mm-hmm. Be happy to. Yeah, another point is, one thing we haven't talked directly about is the definition that I give brilliant cultures, and that is that they're organizational systems that proactively respond to change in ways that decrease stress and inspire learning and promote organizational success. And the reason I think this is important is, and we all know, you know, we have so much change coming at us in the business world, and almost everybody experiences that. And so I wanted to create a way for organizations to create cultures that could adapt to change more easily, that would help them to be successful. So the book also talks about how you design a culture so that you can adapt to change more easily in a way that's positive versus how change is often perceived, which is it's something draining, right, or something challenging. Mm-hmm. So making change easier for companies is another point in the book. That I think a lot of people could benefit from or resonate with.
That's very valid. Let's keep going. Can you give us one more?
Absolutely, yeah. So another piece of it is when I'm designing, helping organizations design a cultural change, one of the things that we always do is we prototype the change. So it's not me coming up with a design for the change. I work very much with the organization. So we've come up with a design. The organization's gone through a process of assessing how the culture operates now. They've decided and determined the kind of culture they need to be successful and brilliant and strategic. And then we design, you know, a way to move between point A and point B. And what we know, and those of us who work a lot in change, is that sometimes things look really good on paper, but they don't work nearly as well in reality. So I really believe in prototyping any change process. So we'll take a team or we'll take a couple departments and we'll try something out. Maybe it's a new way of communicating or something like that. And we'll try it out for a certain amount of time, a few weeks or a month, and then get feedback on what needs to be tweaked and changed. So before the change gets implemented throughout the organization and integrated, a company can be fairly, at least a little more relaxed that we've already prototyped the changes and they worked in, you know, they worked, we got, they worked here, they didn't work there, we've adjusted accordingly. So I think that's a really important piece for listeners, that if you're thinking about a change, really spend some time prototyping it and try it out first on a very small scale to make sure it's going to work the way you think it's going to work. And that can alleviate a lot of stress down the road.
Well, Claudette, I'm going to ask you another one, which oftentimes comes across my desk from our listeners. Well, how do you change customer service? You know, customer service often is the first time someone meets an audience, meets a company, is that a customer service. And, you know, it varies so greatly and it affects so many people. What do you, when you go in there, what do you do in customer service that can help our small business audience?
Absolutely, yeah. And so in most organizations, every department, there's the larger organizational culture, and then every department usually has its own culture also, right, a subculture. So customer service, I would be really interested to, you know, especially even if it's just two or three people in doing customer service in a small company or less, you know, what is the culture of customer service, right? From the perspective of the people who are the customer service representatives or folks, and then the people in the rest of the company, how is customer service viewed? And really get a sense of that culture first, and then see is that how does that culture work? Is customer service working well, or could it stand to be changed or improved, right? And then get a good sense of the culture you'd like customer service to have, and have customer service is very involved throughout this entire process, right? Because they're the people in the culture, and run the same set of ideas that how do you design that change, right? And what I often find in companies is that customer service, it depends on the company, but sometimes doesn't feel valued enough. You know, they feel kind of put upon, or they don't get enough credit for the challenges they have. And that when they feel a little more valued and appreciated, that sometimes can make a big difference too.
Well, those are good words of advice. We have just one or two minutes left. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our audience?
Yeah, so if you're thinking about a cultural change or you're just curious about your culture, whether you're a large company or a small company, this what I'm going to say next applies. I think one of the best things to do initially is to become what I call a cultural detective, which simply means becoming a really good listener and a really good observer of how your culture operates. Start noticing patterns, how people behave, what people talk about, and just be very curious about it. And it's a great way to start to understand what's going on in your culture because you're in it every day, right? So you might as well make it a good one.
Well, on that note, we've been talking with Claudette Rowley. Her book is Cultural Brilliance, the DNA of Organizational Excellence. A link to her website will be on our website tonight. And we thank you, Claudette, for being our guest. It was really an illuminating time. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Don. I appreciate it.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes, hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. For family, long a center of his life was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.